My dear friends, this night is the holiest and most awesome in the entire Jewish year. Its primary purpose, of course, is to provoke in each of us the most penetrating kind of ethical inventory. On other occasions, we may properly inquire into the moral deficiencies of our society and our fellow men. On this night, the proper ground for each man's search is within himself. Any one of us who leaves this hour of worship without feeling honest remorse for his mistakes of the past and genuine determination to improve his conduct in the future will have failed to observe this occasion at anything like its deepest dimension. In the hope of stimulating such spiritual assessment, in myself, believe me, no less than in you, I have chosen to cast this sermon in a form which some of you may at first think morbid. I do so as a consciously calculated risk. This is, if you please, a form of spiritual shock therapy. My theme is really quite simple. Suppose you knew tonight that you had only 12 more months to live. What would you do about it? What plans would you make? What changes would this knowledge bring about in your accustomed way of living? This question, you know, isn't anywhere near as fantastic as it may at first appear to be. For the fact of the matter is, dear friends, that every one of us does have a limited, though unknown, number of months left to live. Pretending that number to be 12 would simply serve the purpose of speeding up our spiritual rate of metabolism, so to speak, of exposing the values by which we live, as if to the magnified view of a microscope. There are, moreover, hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals alive on this earth tonight who do literally face this knowledge, who know that they have at most another year to live. I first thought of this theme many years back when the late A.H. Friedland, one of America's most eminent Jewish educators and Hebrew poets, was told by his physicians that he could anticipate at most another year of earthly existence. I watched him turn that year into the most prolifically creative period of his entire life, writing Hebrew sonnets all day and through most of the night, as if with one eye constantly glued on the clock, determined to squeeze out the last drop of his creative urge before the ink of life could run dry on him. I thought of this theme again when reading Helen Keller's essay, which you may remember, and which is entitled, 3 Days to See. An essay which was prompted by the careless remark of a foolish friend who said to Miss Keller that she had not seen anything particularly interesting on a walk from which she had just returned. This stimulated Helen Keller to think of how little many of us make use of the gift of sight, and to speculate on what she would choose to see if the thick, heavy curtain of blindness could be lifted from her eyes for just 72 hours. She listed a good many things most of us normally take for granted, among them the faces of a baby and her friends, a walk through the woods at twilight, the picture, the colors of her pictures and rugs and books. I wondered then, and have wondered many times since, what you and I would choose to see if we had but 3 days of sight. The same kind of curiosity has come to me on a somewhat different level when I read many years ago, as some of you must have, about a tragic fire which took place in a Maryland nursing home for the aged. One poor old woman had actually been rescued from the flames and was clear of the building when suddenly she thought of her favorite chair, a plain old wooden kitchen chair. She struggled loose from the grasp of the physician who had saved her life, dashed frantically back into the building for her chair, and was found a little later sitting in it, burned to death. That woman and Helen Keller and A.H. Friedland each showed in a moment of crisis what was most important to him. An unfinished book of Hebrew sonnets, a list of things to see, and a battered old kitchen chair. What would you choose as the most important thing in your life if you knew tonight that you had but 1 year left? There are, I should think, at least 4 major ways in which a man or woman might react to such news as this. First, and especially if he be a husband and father, I suppose his first reaction might well be to embark upon a feverish quest to amass for his family all the wealth he could collect for them in the limited number of months he had left. For want of a better term, suppose we call this the way of hoarding. Now, no man, good friends, who has a wife and 2 children whom he deeply and dearly loves would want to minimize, even for a moment, this perfectly natural, understandable desire of every man to provide for his family some measure, at least, of economic security. Despite which, permit me to submit for your careful consideration that the way of hoarding is far from an adequate response, either for the man with 12 months to live or for the man with a whole lifetime before him. No matter how cleverly and unconsciously it be disguised as a desire to provide for his loved ones, what it really boils down to at last is that money and the things money can buy become the most important objectives in life. That material possessions, which ought to be but the limited means of existence, become instead the all-absorbing ends of human striving. I quite agree that the man with only 12 months to live ought to pay careful attention to the things he would leave his loved ones. The question which keeps gnawing at my heart is not this, but whether, having provided for them at least a margin against actual destitution, he should not then pay attention to things other than material possessions that he would leave them. Our fathers seem to have understood this a great deal better than do many of us. One of the most distinctively eloquent forms of medieval Hebrew literature is the so-called ethical will, many of which, incidentally, have been translated and published in English. They provide brilliant insight into our grandparents' scale of values. It wasn't money at all these men were anxious to leave their sons and daughters. They loved their children at least as much as we love ours. But when they sensed life's end approaching, they wrote wonderfully inspiring wills in which they bequeathed to their offspring such things as character and ethical values and a proud, passionate love of their Jewish people and faith. You wouldn't think them foolish or impractical at all. If you could sit with me in my study and watch the procession of people who come to me with their anxieties and heartaches, not more than 4 or 5 times across the span now of more than 21 years, can I remember any such whose basic problem was really lack of economic security? Quite to the contrary. Some of the most desperately unhappy among them were men or women whose parents had supplied for them not only security, but wealth. It wasn't enough. It wasn't enough because there was something more important than security and wealth together that was lacking. The wise parent with 12 months to live would seek to discover, if he could, what that something is. I would not want to be misunderstood at this point. I am not pleading the virtues of poverty, neither for others nor for myself. Asceticism, as a matter of fact, is contrary to the essential nature of Judaism. What I am saying is this, that he who makes the pursuit of material gain the chief objective of his life will never reach a point of fulfillment. And he who leaves his loved ones only wealth or even chiefly wealth, has left them nothing. If I knew that I had 12 months to live, I would seek to recapture the wisdom of the ancient rabbi who asked, "Eze hu ashir, who is a rich man?" And who immediately answered, "Ha someach bechelko, he who is satisfied with his material portion." Well then, if the way of hoarding won't do, how about the way of distraction? Surely there must have been some few of you at least whose instinctive response when I posed my question at the beginning was that with the knowledge of only 1 year of life left, you would want to go out and have all the fun you could find to drown your dismay in distraction. It shouldn't take more than a minute, quite literally, to dispose of that. To say in the first place that fun as a camouflage for reality may be a legitimate juvenile objective, I'm not even sure of that, but most certainly is not a valid hope or ambition for adult men and women. And to add in the second place that the principal trouble with distraction is that it just never works. Sometimes I think that the greatest fallacy in all the forms of foolishness we hear so frequently is the advice so often given to one broken with grief or threatened with emotional upheaval that he should go away on a trip. Away from what? From himself? A trip to where? To some place where he doesn't have to take himself along? No, dear friends. The road to emotional stability and wholesomeness and health cannot be the road of self-deception and distraction. We cannot hide ourselves permanently from the facts, be they pleasant or unpleasant. The way to proper living and health is to face facts and accept them, not to pretend them out of existence. The trouble with some of the currently most popular forms of so-called religious revival is that they encourage men and women to put blinders over their eyes instead of strengthening them to face truth and triumph over it. If Jacob had run away from the angel, he would have lost his unique place in history. It was because he confronted the angel and wrestled with him that he became Israel, Yisrael. For thou hast striven with God and with men and hast prevailed. The man who knew that he had 12 months to live would first of all have to accept that fact and adjust himself to it, not seek to forget it by playing foolish games with himself. Very well then, how about the way of self-pity? There's always a temptation, is there not? When the problems and disappointments of life seem overwhelming, to take refuge in feeling sorry for ourselves. And there would be, I suppose, a very special temptation in this direction for the person who had just discovered that he had 1 year of life left. He could spend that time, in a manner of speaking, every minute of it, prematurely mourning his own death, steeped in morbid grief over the approaching end. Do you remember the bizarre newspaper account of some years ago which told of the man who conducted what might be called a dry run of his own funeral, who went through the precise entire ritual, if you please, of his own funeral service in advance because he wanted so desperately to see and hear all of it. Every one of us knows men and women who, though they may not have gone to that foolish extreme, nevertheless live their lives in constant dread of death. Bernard McFadden, who parachutes at the age of 83. A woman who refuses to permit her skin and hair to grow old gracefully and beautifully. William Randolph Hearst, who for years prohibited the word death even from being spoken in his household. All these are examples of human beings who, in one way or another, are obsessed with the ultimate and inevitable end of life. There would be many things wrong with a person who spent his last 12 months mourning his own imminent passing. Chief among them, I suspect, would be the fact that whether he meant it so or not, he would, by his conduct, be disclosing that for him, the highest value in life, the thing that counts most in life, the criterion above all others by which life is to be judged, is purely the accident of its length. Yet see how foolish, how utterly, unforgivably foolish it would be to measure in this way. Do we use such a standard in any other spiritual or cultural area of life? Do we judge the greatness of music by the number of notes it contains? Or the excellence of poetry by the quantity of its verses? Or the genius of a painting by the area of its canvas? Why then should we so foolishly assume that the man with 12 months to live necessarily has less for which to be grateful than the man with 12 years? Who among us, dear friends, who among us has not from time to time experienced more of love, of beauty, of strength in 30 minutes than at other times in half a year? If you had your choice between 1 year of torture or even monotony and 1 week of tingling, exultant joy, which would you choose? Be careful how you answer that question, even to yourself. You may be disclosing more than you intend about the kind of human being you are. But whatever your answer, understand with me that the measure of a man's life is not its length, but what does he do with his portion of days or years on this earth? 12 months to live, that's only incidental. The real question is, what will you do with them? Will you make them for yourself and for everyone whose life touches yours months of unforgettable beauty and strength? Or will you waste them in miserable, corrosive self-pity? No, the way of self-pity won't do any more than the way of hoarding or of distraction. How then shall we spend our 12 months? The answer is implicit, I think, in everything that has already been said. We must live every hour of these 12 months like consciously creative partners of God. Now, because I know that most of you aren't familiar with this kind of theological language, let me try my very best in a moment or two to say exactly the same thing more simply and more directly. The human race at large is thus far the highest, most refined product of the entire process of evolution that has been going on now for something like 2 billion years. We are literally the heirs of every experiment in animal life which preceded us on this planet. But there are vast, imponderable differences between ourselves and every previous form of life on this earth. Chief among these differences are the facts that, A, with us evolution exists on a spiritual as well as a physical plane, and B, we are not merely passive instruments in the evolutionary process. Which means to say that we, unlike our animal predecessors, can consciously affect the future. We can either speed up or retard the process of evolution by the measure of our cooperation with the great creative force behind evolution, with God. Let me be even more specific. When the pivotal hinge on which the future of evolution depended was the development of two arms in place of front legs. The species of life in which this change was slowly taking place themselves knew nothing about it and could in no possible manner have affected it. The process was, as far as they were concerned, entirely an unconscious one. They were passive instruments rather than active agents. Today, the hinge on which future forms of life depend is the development of such spiritual traits as character and creativity and conscience. Spiritually, we stand today at the birth of a new species of life, the great promise of which can be but dimly glimpsed in this present moment. And it is, dear friends, precisely in the spiritual areas of life where we can ourselves affect the future by our active, conscious, deliberate cooperation with the power behind life, the power called God. What does all this have to do with our 12 months to live? I think everything. It gives us an entirely new purpose and motive for life. If all this be true, then what counts about human existence is not the accident of its length, but how much has each of our lives contributed to the ongoing, upreaching, ever-aspiring stream of life. Has a given individual left this new spiritual development exactly on the level where he found it? Or has he retarded it to a lower level? Or has he helped elevate it still higher? In this light, every single thing we do takes on new and added significance. Every time a human being composes lovely music, or paints breathtaking beauty, or thinks ennobling thoughts, he has thereby, through his own effort in cooperation with God, advanced the course of evolution. Each time that any one of us, faced with a lesser good for himself, chooses instead a greater good for others, he thereby moves the whole level of life to a higher dimension. Whenever we succeed in lifting from the weary shoulders of a fellow man some burden of sorrow or grief, whenever we manage to inject into another human life one little bit of courage or hope, we have added our strength to God's. We have become partners with God. We have justified the experiment of human life on this earth. 12 months to live. Here is the way to spend them. Not in greedy hoarding, nor in foolish distraction, nor yet in miserable self-pity, but in doing the work of God for which we were created. Every one of you, without a single exception, can, if he wills it, do more of that in the next 12 months than you did in the last 12 years. Now let me go back in the end to where we started in the beginning. Was this really too morbid for Colnidre night? This thought, this question, what would we do if we had but 12 months to live? It need not have been. It need not have been any more morbid than the comment of the medieval rabbi who sought to explain the injunction, repent one day before thy death. Someone asked him, how can we do this when no man knows the day of his death? And he answered, precisely because no man knows the day of his death, the injunction means repent every day. What difference does it really make whether our question tonight is literally true or not? Perhaps we would be better off to act as if it were true. For this much we know, every one of us has exactly 12 months between this Day of Atonement and the next one. Then will be time enough to plan our life further.